your name and address, and we will send you a support pack. Thank you for listening.
What in the world is going on? Stay tuned to FirstAmendmentRadio.com to find out first, and on satellite at Galaxy 13, Channel 16, Audio 7.70.
Or faith or obedience. Rather, it is the Building and Loan Society. And this, I contend, is what makes It's a Wonderful Life uniquely American. Just 2 years ago, in the year 2002, Anno Domini 2002, if it were, we were told that what had saved the American economy from the miseries of a deep recession was the housing market. There was cheap mortgage money available, and Americans were refinancing their homes, and in fact still are. Now, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are merely the Bedford Falls Building and Loan Society gone national and federalized through presumed loan guarantees for investors. Now, in the film, Potter is the villain. You see, he is a banker. He is the opposite of the Bailey family. He loans money as well, but he doesn't loan money to help them build homes. He loans money so that they can... what? You tell me. In the World Without George sequence, the town is the essence of evil. Taverns, lewd women, everyone makes a living by selling sin to everyone else, or so it seems. And where the productivity originates, the scene doesn't indicate. Potterville, you see, is sleazy. It is poor. Everyone presumably lives in rented housing, presumably owned by Potter. And so what is the message? The message to the film is that George Bailey, the Jimmy Stewart character, made a difference because he helped depositors make loans to one another that were secured by real estate. Well, that was the mode of national redemption in 1946 after a decade of depression and a half a decade of war. Own your own home. Now, on this theological foundation was built Levittown and other post-war tracts. Now, exactly how Bailey did this during the Great Depression, the movie never quite says. For you see, in the real world, building and loan associations did it because the U.S. government changed the laws under Roosevelt's administration regarding fractional reserve banking. There would be no more bank runs. The government, of course, would insure against this. It would make safer what fractional reserve bankers had feared most, borrowing short, in other words, accepting deposits that were redeemable on demand, and lending long, 30-year loans at a fixed rate on real estate. Well, that worked for a while, except that then the government inflated the currency. They raised the interest rates, but they also raised people's dollar-denominated net worth through rising prices or values on their homes. Lenders then made additional loans based on rising property values, more valuable collateral, and so it goes, even today. The Federal Reserve System's policy of depreciating the dollar in order to keep homeowners happy. Mortgage investors are now locked into investments that will plummet in value if price inflation raises long-term interest rates, and the system will either implode in deflation in one long bank run that will not end after one day at 6 p.m., or else the creditors who extended the mortgage loans will see their investments wiped out through something called mass inflation. You know, unlike adherents of the economics of Ludwig von Mises or Murray Rothbard, most people don't watch the movie It's a Wonderful Life and draw inferences based on the implications of fractional reserve banking. You see, we never think about the crucial character in this film, something we need to look at, without whom the movie would have no plot. Now, consider this. There is no name in the movie. He has no name in the movie, or at least no one remembers it. The actor who played him was never seen again. What role did he play? The crucial figure we speak of here is the bank examiner. Throughout the movie, Uncle Billy, played by Thomas Mitchell, lived in fear of the arrival of the bank examiner. The bank examiner served as the agency of final judgment in our film. Without him, only the depositors were a problem, and they were bought off with George's honeymoon money. The bank examiner was a threat because the building and loan was somehow in the red. And not only when Uncle Billy lost the cash. So when the examiner tosses a dollar onto the pile of money given to George Bailey in the final scene, it becomes clear. God was on the side of George Bailey. George Bailey had passed through Judgment Day with flying color. Color. Green. You see, my friends, the film is about forgiveness. And the form it takes is debt forgiveness, just like in the Lord's Prayer. The Lord's Prayer does not say trespasses as in the original Greek. It says debt. Did the depositors forgive the building and loans debt after only one day? No, but they extended the promised day of judgment. For all it took was George's honeymoon money. Now consider this. The amount of George's honeymoon wad of cash was enough in the Depression era to buy a new home without a mortgage. And not just in Bedford Falls, my friends. How he earned all that money by working at his father's building and loan in the 1930s, we were never quite told. And why a bank run ends after only one day is also left somewhat unexplained. And we viewers don't even bother to ask. Oh, Frank Capra was a great director. You see, Bailey's company was in debt. The books would not balance after Uncle Billy lost the money. Now, why George or anyone else would trust Uncle Billy with cash is also never explained. You see, Uncle Billy had a little bit of a drinking problem. Potter stole the money, character played by Lionel Barrymore. Potter was not just a ruthless capitalist, he was a thief. And his assistant was an accomplice. Oh, Potter can win in his war against Bailey only by breaking the rules, you see. And that's why I believe in the future, when someday there will be a remake of the movie It's a Wonderful Life, I believe that Alan Greenspan should star as Uncle Billy. But why does Bailey keep winning? The movie explains this in terms of the Bailey's willingness to lend the money of little people to other little people, but only good people, family men. You see, the Baileys are men of the people. They lend to build homes, the bright side of every man's impulse to accumulate wealth rather than loaning money to the dark side of man, which Potter does, as the No George sequence revealed in the film. Now, after the miracle judgment sequence ends, George rejoices. He sees that his life has made a difference. He runs home shouting, "Merry Christmas to everyone!" And the proof of his redemption, his self-redemption, is when he runs past the bank, looks in the window, sees Potter, and shouts, "Merry Christmas, Mr. Potter!" Potter's response is consistent, a sarcastic, "And a Happy New Year to you, too!" But you see, that's directed at his assistant, not at Bailey, who's kept on running and was out of earshot anyway. It verbally confirms him in his evil ways. And henceforth, we do not see Potter again through the rest of the film. The money he stole presumably remains with him. But Potter does not fear the bank examiner. He probably controls him. Of course, undergirding both the film and our willingness to watch it over and over and over again all these years, 50-some-odd years later, is our understanding that there really is a bank examiner, my friends, and the books will someday be opened. And someday Potter will be caught, and he won't get away with it. But we do not talk about this assumption. We want to believe what the movie teaches, that girls and boys get free presents under the Christmas tree when they are little. And an invading army of grateful people will bring in wads of free money when we really need it. A lot of Americans believe in miracles. They believe in bank examiners. The divisive question is this: is God more like a bank examiner, or is he like Santa? And on what basis, judicially speaking, do these presents under the tree show up? On our good deeds or on grace? This is the ultimate piece of the puzzle in the film, It's a Wonderful Life. It is the most subtle piece. And we don't stop to ask ourselves who is narrating the movie. Why should he bother? Why is this movie set during Christmas? The answer to all three questions is this. From the book of Ephesians, chapter 2, verses 8 to 10. For by grace are ye saved through faith, and that not of yourselves. It is the gift of God, not of works, lest any man should boast. For we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus unto good works, which God hath before ordained that we should walk in them. You see, that's why I would require immigrants to master the film It's a Wonderful Life. It reveals the best that America has to offer. And it expresses the hopes of common Americans. Well, it also became a classic film 3 decades after it was released. Television brought it to a mass audience, the children and grandchildren of the original audience. You know, it's easy to criticize Capra's view of how the economy works. His plots often have holes in them larger than George Bailey's wad of honeymoon cash. But his movies held together and also have held up over decades because the holes are covered over by his fundamental theme. Individual righteousness wins out in the end. And the American system, while open to greedy villains, ultimately rests on ethically solid ground that nice guys really don't finish last. You know, I've seen the film It's a Wonderful Life enough times to let me skip it this season. And I tried a lot of times. But, you know, when I get to the part of the movie when the bank run begins, I turn it off. It was not honeymoon cash that solved the bank runs in America. It was the government's extension of an insurance subsidy and its implied promise of a fiat money bailout by the Federal Reserve System. And this solution has guaranteed inflation ever since in order to keep homeowners happy and depositors asleep. But you see, the movie isn't about fractional reserve banking any more than it's about angels getting their wings. It's about the positive, cumulative, but unseen benefits to many people of individual acts of charity and honesty. But it's also about capitalism, home ownership, small businesses, and sacrificial hard work. That is why immigrants should be required to take a test on It's a Wonderful Life. And by the way, it wouldn't hurt to have political candidates take the test either. I don't know about you, but I suspect that most of them would flunk. What do you think? A little bit of music. Oh, yeah. Stick around. I'll be back in about 30 seconds. I forgot to mention at the beginning of the hour, we have a chat room that's open while I'm online. I'd like to invite you to come join us for those of you who have internet access. I am Jeff Bennett, filling in for Jackie Petru tonight. You are listening to Sweet Liberty. Do come on over and join us in the chat room at www.federalobserver.com. Also, for those of you who care to, you can certainly go to Jackie's website, sweetliberty.org. You can listen to the program live over on her streaming audio, as well as firstamendmentradio.com, and of course on shortwave radio, WWCR, Worldwide Christian Radio on 5.07 megahertz on your shortwave dial. It's good to see you have this many folks in the chat room, but it's still about half what it ought to be. Let's get it loaded. It's amazing. You know, it's interesting coming up to this portion of the essay that I'm sharing with you, which is a compilation of several years' worth of essays that Gary North, who is probably one of the best economic writers in the world today, This is a compilation of several columns he has done on the subject of the film It's a Wonderful Life. And we're very soon going to get to the meat of this commentary, but I have to share with you that as I concluded one of the previous paragraphs, it talks about how the film is not about fractional reserve banking, although that's something that's left many people in this country in big, big trouble. It's not about angels, it's not about wings, but it's about positive, cumulative, but unseen benefits to many people. What are some of those unseen benefits that you might be listening to tonight? I don't mean because it's me. What are some of the unseen benefits of listening to the Sweet Liberty Hour four nights a week? You know, this program has been completely listener-sponsored by Jackie's audience for 6.5 years. Jackie does not run commercials. She's not spending three-quarters of the hour trying to hawk some worthless product to you. Do you get where I'm going here? Number one, it costs money. It costs filthy lucre. I mean, we've got to line the pockets of Mr. Potter to stay on the air now, don't we? Oh, you like that one, Jackie. And I know Jackie's listening tonight. And Jackie, where do you think Mr. Potter lives? Do you think he lives in Nashville or Tel Aviv? Take your pick. It doesn't matter. But the fact of the matter is, ladies and gentlemen, it is due to your individual acts of honesty, integrity. I don't like to use the word charity because we're not giving something for nothing. You're contributing to keep the important work of Jackie Petru and Sweet Liberty coming to the airways four nights a week. And I hate to say this because it sounds like I've been watching public television lately, and as a matter of fact, I have been. What is this program worth to you four nights a week? Is it worth $1 a night? Is it worth $1 a week? Is it worth $52 a week? $52 a year? That's a decision that only you people can make. Where would you go if Sweet Liberty was not broadcasting at this hour four nights a week? Who is there else to listen to? Well, I guess you could go climb the stairway to paradise. There's certainly many, many other programs out there that will be more than happy to pass the collection plate and promise you salvation and the keys to the gates of heaven. But I'm talking about hardline historical and political commentary. There's no one left out there doing it night after night after night or day after day as Jackie Petru is doing it. And I know there's a lot of you folks out there listening that have been longtime listeners of my program, Perspectives on America, which is currently on hiatus. Jackie's it. And if Jackie leaves the airwaves, you're going to get stuck with the smoke and mirrors, the three-ring circus, and the dog and pony show. I suggest, and I urge you, and I am asking you, to support the work of Sweet Liberty. There's a couple things you can do. You can pick up the telephone, and you can pledge a contribution to Jackie at area code 570-537-3035. That's 570-537-3035. Or you can just sit down tonight and write out a check. And you know what? Don't even make the check out to Jackie Petru. I hope I'm not blowing it here, but you could just make the check out to WWCR. And Jackie will forward the funds on. Problem is, she probably needs to forward some of those funds on to First Amendment Radio as well. You want to send her a check? You want to send her a money order for as much as you can comfortably afford? Don't take food out of the mouths of your babies, your grandbabies. Don't put yourself in debt to do it, but do the right thing. And keeping Jackie Petru and Sweet Liberty on the air is doing the right thing. She is the last voice out there worth listening to. I've known Jackie a long time. That's one of the reasons I'm sitting here, ladies and gentlemen, because of my relationship with Jackie. She's not paying for tonight. I am. You can send her your contribution. Care of Jackie Petru, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, Pennsylvania. That's Jackie Petru, P-A-T-R-U, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, Pennsylvania. Zip code's 16936. But you know what? To be sure how she wants to check to the money order endorsed, pick up the phone and call her after this program tonight at area code 570-537-3035. 6.5 years of listener-sponsored radio. You don't have to listen to the commercials. And that is worth it. Thanks for that commercial moment. Well, as I shared with you earlier, it happened to me again. I didn't plan on it, but I got hooked again by the same old movie, Wonderful Life. I tell myself every year, I'm not going to watch it again. I've had it. It seems like I always do. I mean, how many times can you see it? I've probably seen it 30, 35, 40 times. And I'm not the only one, because millions of others tune in to see the movie It's a Wonderful Life. Jimmy Stewart, he was from Pennsylvania. You know, I tuned in one night accidentally recently, close to the beginning. The screen had a fixed frame image of Jimmy Stewart, his arms wide apart, as if he were describing a huge fish that got away. In fact, he was describing a huge dream that would get away from him again and again and again until the very end of the movie when he quit chasing it. So why do we watch? Because we know that millions of other people are watching in the social cocoons of our living rooms. We share an experience with millions of other people. We know we're sharing the experience, which somehow makes it more meaningful. What Passover is to Jews, so is watching a primetime network Christmas television movie for America's Gentiles. The advertisers love it. You know, seasonal movies aside, two other films serve as primetime national celebrations. The Wizard of Oz and Gone with the Wind, both made in 1939, 7 years before It's a Wonderful Life. But those two movies still continue to draw an audience. But you see, I believe all three of these films, It's a Wonderful Life, Wizard of Oz, Gone with the Wind, they're all united by one theme, and that theme is there's no place like home. And yet each tells a different version of the story. Each conveys this truth in a unique way, but it's the same theme over and over and over. You see, Dorothy runs away from home for the sake of her dog, Toto, because nobody seems to appreciate her on the Kansas farm. Broken down showman and a broken down rig on the road convinces her to go home. She heads home, and then the tornado intervenes. And the movie moves from black and white to technicolor. It shows the discontinuous nature of the movie. Toto, I don't think we're in Kansas anymore. She still wants to go home. And yet all of the miracles and the spells and all of the wizard's theatrics cannot get her home. But clicking her slippers, the ruby slippers, three times does it. The message is home is where your family is. Home is where your family is. And for Scarlett O'Hara, not being hungry again was her stated goal. But the lesson she learned is that there is no place like home. Money and travel and rent are temporary substitutes for home. She finally goes back to Tara when everything else turns sour. The movie's theme song is Tara's theme, and the message was, home is where your land is. But in It's a Wonderful Life, George never leaves home, but he wants out. From the beginning to the end, the story is about a man who struggles with finding home. He wants to travel and do great things. He doesn't travel, and nor does great things. But at the end, he discovers that he did do a great thing. It is this discovery that is the heart of his redemption. He discovers a world of miracles at the margin, but he discovers it in his drafty home. And the movie conveys a fundamental message that home is where your mortgage is. But ladies and gentlemen, all three movies are wrong. You see, home is where your rest is, above all, your eternal rest. But this scene is rarely seen in Hollywood movies. A man called Peter is one of the few. I'll be back After a quick message from my good friends at First Amendment Radio, you're listening to Sweet Liberty, and I'm your guest host tonight, Jeffrey Bennett.
Years ahead of the dominant media, find out first on FirstAmendmentRadio.com, on satellite, Galaxy 13, Channel 16, Audio 7.70.
Roll away the dawn.
You have been listening to Jackie Petrou's Sweet Liberty program on the First Amendment Radio Network. This broadcast is also archived and audio streamed on the Internet at FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Sweet Liberty is a fully listener-sponsored program. Your donations to support these broadcasts are a necessity. Send your check or blank money order to Jackie Petrou, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, PA 16936. Again, send your check or blank money order to Jackie Petrou, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, PA 16936. Be sure to visit the sweetliberty.org website. Thank you for your continued support. And stay tuned to FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
For the second half hour of Sweet Liberty. I'm your guest host, Jeff Bennett, filling in for Jackie tonight, as our plan is I will be doing for each Thursday night for the month of December. We're talking a bit tonight about the movie It's a Wonderful Life, and the story is about to begin to take a new direction. We're going to talk about this film being a conflict of visions. We introduced two chief characters of the film earlier on in our dissertation tonight, Mr. Potter, the evil banker, and George Bailey, who's the head of the building and loan. So we're going to talk about these conflict of visions, Potter's versus Bailey's, the bank versus the building and loan. Today we call them savings and loans, and rentals versus mortgages. And then ultimately, though, it was never said in the film, it's about the FDIC and the FSLIC, you know, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation and the Federal Savings and Loan Insurance Corporation. That's the one I like, FFLIC. Yeah, okay. This same conflict is with us today, my friends. It's driving the price of housing to unsustainable levels in California and Boston and, yes, even here in Arizona, where I live. And certainly other coastal centers, Washington, Oregon, it goes on and on, the Virginias. And yet rental income is not keeping pace with the rise in home prices, the classic sign of a housing bubble getting ready to burst. You know, we've all bought homes in Bailey Park rather than renting in Pottersville, because you see, home is where your mortgage is. In 1946, this was the most important socially one of the most important social issues facing America. Would Americans rent or own their homes? The movie opened in December of that year, 1946, and within months, Levittown went into operation. The suburbs were about to come into being, sustained by government-funded highways and mass-produced automobiles. The returning vets wanted to own their own homes, and if that meant moving away from small-town life, so be it. It's a Wonderful Life is an exercise in nostalgia today, because Levittown and the FSLIC guaranteed the replacement of small-town life, where there are a few jobs and a few new homes. The movie in 1946 identified the future. Bailey Park, a subdivision where the Martinis could buy a piece of America and even bring their goat, as though zoning and restrictive covenants would not keep that world out. And the movie was amazingly subtle, despite its unsubtle script. It's about a conflict of visions. It seems to be about Potter's thwarted vision versus George Bailey's thwarted vision. But there is a third vision, my friends, which turns out to be the triumphant vision. The third vision was rarely discussed and barely perceived, and yet it is the movie's core vision. It is presented in a far more subtle way. It's the vision that turned It's a Wonderful Life into a classic film 4 decades after it was made. Therein lies the secret of its popularity to this day. You see, the third vision is that of Donna Reed's character, Mary Bailey. She wishes for the old home in the rock-throwing sequence. She wants to build a home out of an abandoned, falling-down mansion with broken windows. She wants to buy a money pit and have George pay for it. George promises to lasso the moon for her, but she lassos him instead. And she does it with a phone cord. You see, every man who sees the opening of that scene knows what's going to happen. And so does every woman. Mary's mother on the upstairs extension, who is mentally adding up the rival balance sheet, sees it coming and cannot stop it. You see, Mary wants that house. Sam Wainwright can only offer riches out of town. But that will not give her the chance to fulfill her vision, turning a sow's ear into a silk purse. Sam Wainwright is obviously her beau before she met the Jimmy Stewart, George Bailey character. Now, in this film, the only person I have ever personally identified with was Sam Wainwright. Plastics, baby, plastics. Get in on the ground floor while you can. He stuck his thumbs in his ears, wiggled his fingers, and said, "Hee-haw!" to the whole risk-aversive world. Thank God for the Sam Wainwrights of the world. Thank him also for the free market, which lets them get rich by making us more productive and our world better. The movie's symbolic key to the fundamental conflict of visions, Mary's versus George's, get this, is that loose knob on the banister. Never does get fixed, does it? There's always something else to fix, but never enough time to fix the knob. George keeps grabbing the knob and running up the stairs, and then he puts it back. But he just won't glue it. The question I asked from the very first time I ever saw the film, and even until the latest, is this. Why doesn't somebody glue the damn knob? Well, I finally figured it out. It took me darn near 40 years to do it. And I'm sure that film reviewers have figured it out, but I'm a little bit of a slow learner. You see, that loose knob symbolizes the conflict of visions between the Baileys. George wants out of Bedford Falls, out of the lending business, out of that drafty house, and ultimately out of life. The movie never says it explicitly, but he wants out of his marriage, a decidedly non-Jimmy Stewart theme. He wants the freedom to get out. Glue the knob, and he's trapped. The knob is the symbol of his moral battle. Will he finally settle down mentally? He's settled down economically and geographically, but he's not settled down mentally. Will that knob ever be glued? You see, Mary won't fix it. She knows that George has to, as a symbol of his acceptance of his life. And George won't fix it for the same reason. Will Mary Bailey win the battle of the conflicting visions? It's obvious from the final scene of the film that she wins. George is at last locked in, grinning. He will not go to jail. Uncle Billy won't go to a mental institution, although he should have joined AA, and George should have fired him back in 1930. The building and loan is saved. Bailey Park is saved. Potter is once again thwarted. And Clarence gets his damn wings. All's well that ends well. But the conclusion, of course, is let's all go out and buy a home with a 30-year fixed interest rate mortgage. Let's all move to Bailey Park. And yet, in fact, that's what we've all done. And yet it's, in fact, bad economics. The movie seems to be about slums versus new subdivisions. In the miracle sequence, Pottersville is a downtown jungle of bars and lewd stage shows and pawn shops and prostitutes. That's Potter's vision and neon. But the message is only mortgage money can save Bedford Falls from becoming Pottersville. Well, economically, it's nonsense. Fractional reserve banking is the road to monetary perdition, but fractional reserve savings and loans are not the road to heaven. That both roads are today protected by the government-subsidized FDIC is merely symbolic, my friends. You see, the FSLIC, the FSLIC, went bust in the 1980s, and this event threatened to take the American economy down along with it. And borrowing short and lending long for mortgages was the heart of that crisis, and taxpayers' money by the hundreds of billions was necessary to keep us from the path of redemption paved by George Bailey. Now, you know, I've never seen a reviewer, and many of you who've heard me for the last dozen years or so, or 10 years, know that I'm an old film buff. In fact, on the Federal Observer, we have a segment called It's a Wonderful Life, and some of what I'm sharing with you here tonight is posted on there in one of Gary North's columns. But once again, what I'm sharing with you is kind of a little bit of personal commentary and an intermix of some of North's work. I never seen a reviewer mention what should be obvious. You see, this movie achieved classic status after 1984. Now, this was an inflationary era in which housing prices soared. We had three recessions, 74, 81, and 82, with high interest rates in the 80 to 85 period, producing an outflow of funds from savings and loans to the newly invented money market funds, which produced the savings and loan crisis, which were borrowed short and lent long, and the collapsing S&L industry threatened to bring down the American dream, homeownership. By ending government-guaranteed mortgages, that would have meant the end of the wonderful life circa 1985. In 1946, the movie barely broke even. But, you know, each generation gets trapped in its own house, which reflects its very own vision. In 1946, the big old house, still drafty, was pictured as the American dream come true. A woman with a vision lasses a husband to fund her personal reclamation project. He sacrifices his vision for hers and every other wife's in Bedford Falls. And even Violet gives up her vision of an escape to the big city. Violet was one of the characters in there that was kind of a little bit of a loose woman. Of course, then we had Zuzu's generation. They left Bedford Falls no later than 1960, returning for Thanksgiving and Christmas to visit the old folks. The F-Flix secured the subsidized funding for the movie. The Levittowns of America, the Burbs. Almost nobody under 70 lives in Bedford Falls anymore. We may dream of moving back in our old age, but it's just a dream. Jackie lives in Bedford Falls, don't you? You see, we all work in cities. We commute to the Burbs, and so do our children. There's no more neighborhoods. There's only subdivisions. And when you come out here to Arizona, every single little United Nations home has got a black wall around it. I don't know if that's to keep the neighbors out or to keep me in. When the building and loans went bust in the mid-1980s, no one collected a basket full of cash to bring to the founder's sons. Instead, voters called on Congress to bail out the system, and Congress obliged. And Zuzu's kids and the grandkids will be paying for that bailout in 50, 60, 80 more years. You can call the entire process from Bailey to bailout. But you see, the major crisis of the movie is the run on the building and loan. Why it could be solved in one day, as we've shared with you earlier, was never explained. How the newlywed Baileys had scraped together $2,000 for a honeymoon in 1932. And by the way, that's worth about $28,000 today. 14 times. And you know what? They could have bought a home for $2,000 back in 1932 and had a few bucks left over, by the way. But man, what a honeymoon that would have been, huh? Woo-hoo! But you see, it was that fear of depression and bank runs in 1946 that still paralyzed millions of members of the older generation. You know, the head of Montgomery Ward, Sewell Avery, was convinced that another depression was imminent. And so he had Montgomery Ward hoard cash. He refused to go into debt to expand. Well, Sears did. They built stores on the newly invented shopping malls of the suburbs. Montgomery Ward's never recovered. Of course, Sears is now merged with Kmart, and they'll both get swallowed up by Walmart, so what's the difference? And then we had the Full Employment Act of 1946. That was signed into law, guaranteeing government intervention to ensure full employment without inflation. The Federal Reserve System, in turn, guaranteed that law. That fact guaranteed inflation. Today, it takes nearly $9,800 to match the purchasing power of $1,000 in 1946. You understand what I just said? What your parents could have bought for $1,000 in 1946, it cost $9,800 to match it today. Federal government's mortgage loan guarantees have now trapped generations of Americans into long-term mortgage debt to pay off the Bailey Park homes that we all believe is a fulfillment of the American dream. Pottersville, of course, is confined to central cities where residents' credit ratings are low or non-existent. Only the down-and-outers live there, and Latinos who move two or three families into a home to make the mortgage payments. Oh, they're the up-and-comers in the Southwest in Miami. Oh, those Latinos, they're coming over the border tonight. They're making the American dream work for them, changing it as they do. You and I are left out in the cold, paying their ability to do it. The film's surface theme is that miracles occur at the margin. Bailey makes loans to borrowers who buy homes. One by one, the community changes. Old homes are restored. George lives in one. New homes go up. Potter's rental income falls when families move to Bailey Park. Loan by loan, everyone with character can buy a piece of the American dream. And that's what keeps Bedford Falls from turning into Pottersville. It's a fairy tale for grown-ups, people. Potter would have had competition from other banks. If Bailey's building and loans survived the Great Depression, it would have had imitators. But the basic theme of the film was that greed thwarts the good life, but self-sacrifice builds a decent place to live. And that theme resonates with Americans. Indeed, it's a fundamental theme of the Bible. But the problem is we've all bought into the 1946 vision of the crucial arena of greed versus self-sacrifice, the mortgage market. Anything that undermines cheap mortgage money is seen as Potterism. Cheap mortgage money is seen as the American's birthright. It wasn't in 1930. Back then, people had to pay 40% down to buy a house, just as they do today in most European nations. But in 1947, Levittown began to change all that with help from the government. A new home in a suburb for $10,990 cost $67 a month. Buy now, pay later. Paralleled by the borrow short, lend long, the first slogan governs the borrowers. The second governs the lenders. It is a symbiotic system. It rests upon fractional reserve banking and central banking, which ensures the commercial banks by guaranteeing permanent monetary inflation. But the miracle of the free market is this, that the idea of miracles at the margin. The West's economy has grown at 2-3% per year, compounded despite wars for 250 years. Do you know that we live more comfortably than kings did in 1850? And P.J. O'Rourke once said that when you think the good old days, think dentistry. The miracle is the compounding process. The fly in the ointment is fiat money and the expansion of debt that it subsidizes. Everywhere we turn, my friends, we're caught in a massive web of debt. The debt is denominated in currency units, mostly dollars. The web holds because central banks keep buying government debt, which expands the monetary basis, which multiplies through the fractional reserve process. And the purchasing power of money falls marginally year after year after year. And the terror of this system is the terror of It's a Wonderful Life, the bank run. It's the terror of banks being borrowed short and lent long. And as voters, we are willing to accept anything that defers this threat. Today, there are $140 trillion in unsecured, high-leverage debt-credit agreements, over 80% of which are tied to shifts in interest rates. That's the derivatives market. A few of us worry that the system is being managed by Uncle Billy, but most people don't know about it. You know, the more I keep looking at photos of Alan Greenspan, the more resemblance I see to Tommy Mitchell. And so, my friends, we're in the midst of a housing bubble in the cities. In other words, blue America. A housing bubble is easy to define, where the monthly mortgage payment for a new buyer's after taxes is higher than a rental payment for a comparable property. That is George Bailey's legacy to America. Now, the bad guy in the movie, once again, was Potter. Potter was a slumlord. The hero was Bailey. He lends depositors money to home buyers. We've been through all this. You know, we really do love the movie's message, home is where your mortgage is. We still believe it. We still feel warm and bubbly when George gets that basket full of money which seals his fate and ours. He really didn't need that basket full of money. You know, George was short $8,000 to cover the bank's losses. But Sam Wainwright had promised to underwrite George to the tune of $27,000, but it was a nice gesture on the part of the neighbors. Clarence got his wings. And so the purchasing power of the dollar, and they've been flying ever since. I know exactly what happened the next day after Clarence got his wings. George went to the tool chest and got out some glue and fixed that knob. He was done. He was finished. So was his dream of escaping Bedford Falls. And so is the dollar. There is a conflict of visions in this life, my friends. There is a war between self-sacrifice and greed. The genius of the free market is that it converts greed into consumer-satisfying productivity. In 1776, Adam Smith wrote, "But man has almost constant occasion for the help of his brethren, and it is in vain for him to expect it from their benevolence only. He will be more likely to prevail if he can interest their self-love in his favor and show them that it is for their own advantage to do for him what he requires of them. Whoever offers to another a bargain of any kind proposes to do this. Give me that which I want, and you shall have this which you want." It's the meaning of every such offer, and it is in its barter. It's what it really is. It's barter. Potter versus Bailey would have produced much of the same outcome. And that's because people finance their dreams in a competitive market. We don't pay cash for our dreams any longer. We finance them. We use credit cards. I was in Walmart the other day. I go there maybe three times a year because there's a product that I can only get at Walmart for the office and the studio. And that's where I had to go to get it. This is the day after Thanksgiving, believe it or not. 2 days after Thanksgiving. I'm standing in the line of the less than 20 items checkout. This is the so-called quickie line. I can't believe how long I stood in line. Six people in front of me, and it took forever to get out of there. I walk up to the register realizing every single person had paid with their purchase with a credit card. Whether they bought one item or six or 20 items, they all paid for a credit card. People finance their dreams on plastic today in this country. And those who have access to money deposit their money in an institution that gives them the best rate of return, consistent with risk. We borrow money from the institution that offers us the best terms. It's lender versus lender and borrower versus borrower. It's not greed versus generosity. This is the socially and ethically revolutionary aspect of free market capitalism. You know, Sam Walton was a nice guy, but his heirs are not worth $100 billion today because Sam was nice. Sewell Avery was a vocal defender of the free market, but he lost out to Sears because he did not understand the economic implications of It's a Wonderful Life. The FSLIC, in conjunction with the Federal Reserve System, was creating a new society with new institutions, the suburb and the shopping mall. And you see, my friends, we now live in George Bailey's world. We have substituted government loan guarantees for bank runs, fiat money for the gold standard, and 30-year fixed-rate mortgages with 5% down, if that, for 5-year balloon payment loans with 40% down. We live in a world where most Americans are in debt all of their lives, dreaming of winning the lottery and having the government guarantee their pensions, their old age, and their health care expenses. Oh, no, my friends, the Buffalo gals have come out tonight to vote by the light of the moon because we have become a nation of lunatics. And that's why we watch It's a Wonderful Life year after year. You see, it comforts us in our lunacy. Oh, it's a good-hearted movie. It's about family values and hard work. But underlying the good is an assumption. Home is where the mortgage is. And yet that assumption is false. It's more widely believed than it was in 1946. Complex? Quite the contrary. It's quite simple. Let me ask you this. How many of you are going to see that movie this year? Maybe you've seen it already. Maybe you've got the VHS or the DVD up on the shelf. And I'm going to tell you what. After tonight's program, you are going to go pull that movie out, or you're going to wait for it to come on NBC next week or whenever, and you're going to watch that movie, and I promise you, you will never watch the movie It's a Wonderful Life and think about it again in the same way. Because the story I've shared with you tonight is going to come back and haunt you every single time you see it. Now, I have but a few minutes left, and I want to do a couple of things. Obviously, many of you know you can go to Jackie's website or that of FirstAmendmentRadio.com. This program will be archived, and you'll be able to download it. But I'd like to suggest to you and invite you to order your own copy of tonight's program. And I'm going to invite you to do it from me. In order to do it, you're going to have to call me at area code 623-327-1778. Yes, I can take your plastic if that's what you absolutely have to do. This program will be available on compact disc. It will also be available on audio cassette. I hate doing that because most people prefer the disc. It will far outlast the cassette. You want to copy it and hand it out to your friends, that's your business. $16.95 for the compact disc, $12.95 for an audio cassette. And the name of the program, real simple, It's a Wonderful Life. I want you to share it with people. I want you to think about the economic ramifications of some of the things we've talked about tonight. 623-327-1778. But you know what? If push came to shove and you happen to be an internet listener and you said, Jeff, I've got $16.95. I want to buy that compact disc. But I can't buy the compact disc and support Sweet Liberty as well. Then you know what you do? You forget about buying the compact disc and you support Sweet Liberty. And you send your contribution to Jackie Petru, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, Pennsylvania, 16936. But if you can afford to do both, I'll be thankful. It'll keep us coming back here as long as you would like us to be here. And one final note. I intentionally came on this program tonight with no intent of doing any kind of an advertisement, any type of a commercial for a product other than the disc and the tape we just talked about. But I'm going to share something with you. I'm 57 years of age, and most of you know this story. At the age of 10, I began to buy solar. At the age of 12, I began to buy gold. I still deal in gold and silver. Just because you're not hearing me on the airways five nights a week doesn't mean I shut down. Most of you know where to find me. Via phone, via address, through the Federal Observer, whatever the case may be. Keep your support of Sweet Liberty going, and as long as you do that, I'll be able to keep coming back here as well. You stop that support, and we're nowhere. Now it's Thursday night. Jackie will be off the air until Monday, and she'll be back. She'll be roaring at you. And Lord willing, I'll be back with you again next Thursday night. Thanks for allowing me to come into your homes and your businesses and through your computers and on the internet tonight. Hope things are going well down in Ponder, Texas, and Kamei, Idaho. Take care of Sweet Liberty. We'll take care of you. Give us a call here at my production company, Kettle Moraine, 623-327-1778. Any questions we can answer for you regarding gold, silver?
Roll away the dawn.
You have been listening to Jackie Petru's Sweet Liberty program on the First Amendment Radio Network. This broadcast is also archived and audio streamed on the internet at FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Sweet Liberty is a fully listener-sponsored program. Your donations to support these broadcasts are a necessity. Send your check or blank money order to Jackie Petru, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, PA 16936. Again, send your check or blank money order to Jackie Petru, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, PA 16936. Be sure to visit the SweetLiberty.org website. Thank you for your continued support. And stay tuned to FirstAmendmentRadio.com.